This is Seattle's Morning News. Dr. Keith Jerome is the head of the UW Virology Lab, and we check with him from time to time to see what's new. And I have to say, every day I hear a new report about a promising vaccine. There's something, there are apparently dozens of them, new therapies that go beyond remdesivir. What do you think are the most promising developments? What are the lights at the end of the tunnel as you see them?
Well, Dave, I think one thing that people are getting an insight to that might be new for them is just a view into how science works. And that is, in terms of therapeutics, we're trying to find more new and better drugs. And so a lot of drugs are being what we call repurposed, that they're drugs that are maybe used for something else. And there's a reason to think maybe, just maybe, they would help against COVID. So they're being tried. What's different here is everybody's getting news so early in the process. And so there's good news and there's bad news. And one day it's up and down. And frankly, that's the life of a scientist in research, that you get these leads and they look good. And then things usually don't pan out, frankly. What people need to focus on are the drugs that have gone through what we call the phase three clinical trials, or at least the larger randomized clinical trials, where they've been tried in a group of patients, typically where some people get the drugs and some don't. And we see whether the people who get the drug do better. And so that's what's happened with remdesivir, for example. That's how we know that it works. Those sorts of trials happen for dexamethasone as well. So we know that works. And those are actually, that's a nice combination of drugs, because remdesivir attacks the virus itself. You want to use that early in the infection. And the dexamethasone sort of tamps down the body's overreaction to the virus. So in combination, they're pretty good. Lots of room to improve, as you know. They're not the perfect drugs at all. But I think people just need to understand there's going to be this news coming back and forth. You asked about the vaccines as well. Now that you're hearing a lot, because there's a lot of companies working on vaccines. There are six that have moved into something called Operation Warp Speed, which is sort of the United States sort of national trials on vaccines. And those will be moving forward now. Moderna will be first, followed pretty closely by one from AstraZeneca. And what you've seen in the news are these early reports in the smaller trials of how they work. And what we know is that they're relatively safe. People get sore arms and sometimes some chills and things when they take them, but it seems to be pretty mild. But we do know that the people who are getting the vaccines make antibodies, and that's what we need in order to fight off the infection. And they seem to make even often more than in the actual infection, which is probably good. So this is all good news, that we've got several different kinds of vaccines all kind of pulling toward the same target in different ways, and they all seem to be working right now. We need to test them in these bigger trials, make sure they're really safe in larger groups of people, and then that they protect. But so far, the news we've gotten is about as good as we could expect.
So are we in a position to safely open schools, in-person schools this year?
Oh, I think that's going to be tough. I sure hope so. I hope we're going to be. I think to do that safely, we've really got to get the virus more under control. I think there's just too many cases and too much community spread right now. And even here in Washington, we've seen an increase in the last couple of weeks. Maybe that's flattening out now, it looks like. I think people have sort of redoubled their efforts. But in other parts of the country, it's still not under control. And it's really scary to think about bringing 25, 30, 35 kids into a crowded classroom that may not be well ventilated. Yeah. And even with the younger ones, they may not get very sick. But it's becoming pretty clear that they get infected and they make a lot of virus and they can spread it to others. And so we don't want to do anything that's going to make this whole situation worse.
So even if you could get all the kids to wear masks, that probably still wouldn't be safe in the current environment?
I think there's so many steps about trying to be as safe as possible through this, or ways you can at least make yourself safer. And masks are great. Being outdoors is great, right? Just that air circulation. So if someone is breathing out the virus, it just sort of wafts away in the breeze. And you just don't get that in the classroom. And yeah, the masks will cut it down, but you're going to be there for 50 minutes or an hour at a time, or in the younger grades for all day. And that's just going to give the virus time to build up. And so I don't know that masks, I think we're asking a lot of masks in that situation.
Well, I don't know if you heard, but the Port of Seattle has offered its parks as a site for outdoor classes, saying that they do this kind of thing all the time. They've got restroom facilities and places to eat and stuff like that. If school was moved outdoors, could you pull it off?
Yeah, that's the sort of creative thinking I was sort of alluding to, that everybody's got ways to contribute to this in their area. And so things like that are fantastic. And yeah, if you could do this outdoors, maybe you could. And there's so much value, Dave, in actually getting human beings together, right? And especially for learning and creating together and thinking of new ideas and sharing and socializing. All that's so important. So if there are a way to do that outdoors, and even if it couldn't be every day, all day for each class, maybe rotate through classes, I think it's fantastic.
And I always end by asking you about next time. What do we learn from this time that we can use to do a better job next time with the next novel coronavirus?
There's clearly a need for a more coordinated response across the country. And I think there need to be mechanisms for doing that. And hopefully that could be better next time. Regions and states are still essentially competing against each other for testing reagents and testing capacity and instrumentation. And that's just unfortunate. And I think it just goes to show you, we can't year after year underfund our public health effort. And we partially got a late start on this because of that, all the way back in what was happening in January and February. We got a late start, and that's part of what's gone wrong. Not all of it by any means. We've certainly made mistakes since then. And then hopefully people will just understand better about how sort of science and medicine works, their response to this, and just understand that there are really well-meaning people who are working really hard to solve these things. But it's hard because it's the unknown, and these are by definition going to be new viruses. And stuff takes time, and it takes coordination, and it takes not being distracted by
politics,
therapies, and things that aren't proven yet. Let's put it this way: listen to the scientists, and we'll give you some data, and then yeah, the our officials can make the decisions based on good information.
Let me just pursue this a little bit. Is there something that the scientists could have done to get people to believe them earlier?
Yeah, within science, we're always talking about that. How do we communicate better with people who aren't necessarily in science? The rest, people who do all the rest of the stuff that it takes to keep society going, right? Not everybody can be a scientist, or I like being a scientist. I guess to be a scientist, but generally, we see our role as sort of laying out data that is reality as best we understand it. And you'll hear us say when we're not sure, when we'll say we think we're pretty sure, we'll say that. And we'll admit that sometimes we can be wrong, and we'll try to correct it as quick as we can. That isn't quite how the political arena works, right? Because changing your mind is sometimes thought of as a weakness, and we're just trying to get at truth. So we're not comfortable in that. I think scientists generally would like to have society as a whole just generally think of us as trying to do the right thing and getting the right answer out there. And we're all depending on our elected officials to listen to us. So what the public can do is really demand that the elected officials at least listen to the scientists. And clearly other things have to be balanced, right? It's not all about the virus. It's also about the economy, and it's about our students' education. And that's not my job to balance those things out, but I can tell you what the effects will be on the virus and what the virus is doing. And ideally, political folks will listen to the scientists, at least about what the data is.
Dr. Keith Jerome, director of the University of Washington Virology Lab. Dr. Jerome, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
And our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places. And this week, the transportation infrastructure project that took more than 100 years to die. And no, we don't mean Sound Transit. Felix?
Yeah, it's a weird one. It first came up during the administration of President Buchanan, or maybe President Pierce, back in the 1850s. I read a newspaper clipping said Jefferson Davis, when he was Secretary of War, supported this. Near as I can tell, it officially died late in President Nixon's first term. Well, what are we talking about? It was a plan to build three canals to improve commercial shipping. And this is, I mean, talk about thinking big. There would be two out on the coast connecting the Columbia River to Willapa Bay, about a five-mile canal, then connecting Willapa Bay to Gray's Harbor, which is about 10 miles, and then the granddaddy of them all, a 58-mile canal from Olympia all the way to Gray's Harbor. So you could go from Puget Sound straight down to the ocean without having to go through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. The idea seems to have been first seriously considered on 1897. It had a couple of points going for it. One was to give marine traffic this inland route all the way from Portland to southeast Alaska, because that southernmost canal would bypass the dreaded Columbia Bar, allowing ships to go upriver of Astoria to Willapa Bay, with another canal then connecting Willapa Bay to Gray's Harbor, and then that longer canal using stretches of the Chehalis River to get to Puget Sound without having to go all the way up to the Washington coast through the treacherous Strait of Juan de Fuca. It probably would have required as many as nine separate locks and lots of bridges. And this idea, it just would not die. And I'm not sure why exactly. It comes up a few times in the teens, around the time the Panama Canal opens. That's understandable. In 1913, the state legislature formally memorialized the U.S. Congress to examine the scheme. And I love this quote from the Seattle Times about this crusty old state senator named Oliver Hall from Colfax down in Whitman County. Before he voted for the memorial, Senator Hall facetiously remarked that he would like to have it referred to a committee so that it could be amended to include appropriation to run the Columbia River through Snoqualmie Pass.
What?
That's Senator Hall being funny, crusty old guy from Whitman County. Anyway, 20 years later, the plan was actually taken pretty seriously in 1933 in the depths of the Depression. Any guess as to why that might have been true, Dave?
No.
It's a jobs program. It was like Infrastructure Week on steroids.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, isn't it sort of a crazy... I mean, would that have cut out Seattle then?
Well, it would have made it easier to get to Seattle without having to worry about going through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. I mean, it probably would have favored Tacoma somewhat. I mean, that's hard to say, but in 1933, the cost of the canal, the big long one, would have been $25 million.
That's nothing.
That's about $500 million in 2020 dollars. It's a classic shovel-ready project, and there were lots of guys looking for shovels back then. The amount of dirt to have been moved in 1933 was 155 million cubic yards, and that figure is unchanged for 2020. I couldn't find a converter for cubic million feet of dirt. and so the taking seriously part in 1933 meant they passed a bill, the governor signed it, they created the Canal Commission of the State of Washington. They produced a report very quickly in June of 1933. Got a copy of it right here in my hand. It's this beautiful little blue hardcover book, all these crazy maps and charts, and it talks about how the canal would be superior in terms of moving troops from Fort Lewis to the coast for defense purposes. I mean, they really put the hard sell on this thing. But the Army Corps of Engineers shut them down about a year later. It kept coming up. In 1941, it came up. They asked the U.S. House to look into it. In 1961, it came up again with the added idea of connecting the lower end of Hood Canal to Puget Sound by a two-mile canal. I mean, they were canal crazy. The last couple mentions I could find in the archives. In 1967, the Army Corps of Engineers actually said that one portion, the Willapa Bay to Grace Harbor, had merit. And then in 1971, the funding ran out and the Canal Commission expired. But if you do the math, it's something like 113 years of action on this canal that literally went nowhere.
Well, we need jobs now, Felix.
You get the shovel. I'll get the shovel, like the wheelbarrow. Let's get down there. We only got 155 million cubic yards to go.
Felix Bunnell, you can hear all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
And, of course, every Friday morning, we talk with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan. And as Colleen mentioned in her newscast, this is shaping up to be a potentially loud and contentious weekend in Seattle. We expect more protests. We expect also federal officers to try to protect any federal buildings near those protests. We've seen them in Portland. They're headed to Chicago and Albuquerque. And Margaret tells us that there's not much local politicians can do about it.
The thing that underpins this is the conviction of the Attorney General and the Justice Department that they have, well within their rights, the ability to send federal agents to encircle and protect federal property in any city in the country, and then along with that, to conduct arrests of those who have committed a federal crime. But of course, that gets you into some pretty uncomfortable territory in terms of how that coexists with local law enforcement, how that's operationalized. And of course, we're in an election year less than 100 days from an election in which President Trump's message is law and order, and there is the suspicion that this smells of politics, not just principle and law enforcement, as Attorney General Barr has argued it is.
And now we're seeing these clashes between federal officers and protesters in Portland are under investigation by the Justice Department Inspector General. They're also investigating those clashes in Washington, D.C. recently. What exactly are they looking into?
Well, that gets to the conduct, particularly of those federal agents. And when I sat down and interviewed Attorney General Bill Barr last month as part of what you just referenced there, the Lafayette Square incidents in which journalists and protesters were pushed back using pepper balls, chemical irritants, and forcibly removed from the area. It is that kind of activity. Was this, encroaching on a First Amendment right of a journalist to be there? Was this undue force that was used? It's how this was operationalized. And this is the question. And this is what skeptics of the argument would point to, which is when you have someone who is trained for Customs and Border Patrol or the Bureau of Prisons out there trying to quell a protest, they don't have the same sort of relationship with the community in which they are operating as your local law enforcement, and that adds a heightened level of tension to it all. But of course, the Justice Department argues that these federal agents were needed in these places because local law enforcement wasn't able to get these situations under control in the first place.
As you've mentioned, and the president has said himself, he is presenting himself as this law and order candidate. He said it himself. Do we have any indication that this hardline stance on crime is benefiting his reelection campaign?
Well, we'll get some answers to that this weekend with our latest battleground tracker, Anthony Salvanto, the CBS elections guru, will be with us to break that down, particularly in terms of how the heartland of this country is responding in this election year. But to big issues like the economy and the virus. But these images of trying to establish order or messaging that is the intention behind it is something the Trump administration and Trump campaign has argued is helpful to them because it is suggestive to, as the president tweeted this week, suburban women, whatever that means, are concerned. And so that is definitely part of a campaign strategy in what the president acknowledged. Whether it actually is a good one or a useful one is another matter.
Let's discuss now the latest round of coronavirus relief in Congress. The latest plan from Senate Republicans does not include a payroll tax cut, which the president has said he wants. Where does the bill stand today?
It is still unclear because Senate Republicans have not released the text of their compromise version with the White House. There is still disagreement between some Senate Republicans on what this will look like. You're right. The president even yesterday admitted that the payroll tax cut that he really wanted to have included wouldn't be in this version of the bill. He's already gesturing to the potential of yet another round of emergency relief. What we know is there's a lot of pressure in this moment to get a package done before the U.S. election. Senate Republicans are eyeing the polls. They are concerned about maintaining their majority hold on that part of Capitol Hill and are also mindful of trying to target some of this aid, but do it in a way that doesn't add up to more than $1 trillion. That's still a lot of money, but it is less than what Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has proposed and already passed with her Heroes Bill in the House. Speaker Pelosi will be with us on Sunday to talk about what this next round of emergency relief could look like. It matters for people who are concerned about evictions. It matters for people who are concerned about how big the boost to their unemployment check will be if that extra $600 shrinks.
Right. Time's running out. That $600 runs out at the end of the month. What are your expectations here? Does the bill get done in time?
Well, there is a lot riding on this. Democrats seem to believe that they have some leverage because it is an election year. And who wants to say that nothing was done to help those who are facing those piling bills? But there is a tremendous amount of spending that's already happened. We have already seen trillions of dollars thrown at this problem, and it's a problem that is getting elongated by the fact that the virus is continuing to spread in these hotspots. Once you get the virus under control, you can get the economy back on track. And unfortunately, the surges have offset some of that recovery in the states, in the South and in the West.
We heard from the president yesterday that he's calling off a portion of the Republican National Convention that was set for Jacksonville, Florida. What do you make of the president's shift in tone this week on the outbreak? He's now saying masks are patriotic, saying it's going to get worse before it gets better, saying right now is not the right time to hold a big convention. Why is his message changing?
You know, that's a good question. There's some speculation and reporting, including from some of my CBS colleagues, that it is based on the fact he's seeing poll numbers that show that he may be in trouble in certain states when it comes to the head-to-head matchup with Joe Biden. But this change in message also may be reflective of the fact that where the virus is surging are in states that, in many, with the exception of California here, were states that voted for President Trump in 2016. These were perceived to be red states, mostly red governors, mostly Republican governors, and they are seeing problems. So he is seeing leaders from within his own party really struggle with a virus that the White House had assured them was past its worst, that it was going to be better in these summer months, that there was enough equipment. And yet those governors, even though they saw what happened here on the East Coast of the country and out West as well, seem to be caught unprepared in many places. Arizona and Texas, they're playing catch up. South Carolina playing catch up. There's a real concern, and people are seeing infection rates and hospitalizations climb.
Also, lastly, I want to get your reaction to the latest tensions between the United States and China. There is this tit for tat happening, China ordering the U.S. to close a consulate in Chengdu. This is in direct retaliation to the U.S. closing China's consulate in Houston. You covered the State Department for a long time. How bad is the relationship right now?
It is an incredible point of tension. As you just mentioned, these shuttering of diplomatic facilities is an extreme example of that. It shows that the president's long-promised trade deal is totally on ice. It shows that the two largest economies in the world have not improved their relations. They have only spiked in tensions. And it's interesting because this is one of the very few bipartisan issues in the country. There is a desire to see American leaders be tough on China, to deal with all the problems we know exist in the trade relationship. And you're going to see candidate Joe Biden and President Donald Trump try to out-tough each other on this message. The Trump administration took that to another level this week, but specifically said that was due to espionage being conducted at American universities, medical facilities, and U.S. corporations, even indicted two hackers who were stealing research, some of it related to the coronavirus. So they're arguing, the Trump administration, that it has just reached a level of brazenness that they could not leave unaddressed and shuttered this Houston consulate this week.
That's Margaret Brennan, host of CBS's Face the Nation. And now to the latest on the COVID-19 outbreak, the runaway growth of the coronavirus in Washington state, prompting Governor Jay Inslee to issue new restrictions for businesses. We get the latest from Kiowa Radio's Hannah Scott.
Governor Inslee and health officials have been building up to it for days as daily cases of COVID-19 hit rolling averages for 2 weeks of more than double where they were just a few weeks ago, topping out at more than 1,000 cases a day in some days. Yesterday, the state health department reported nearly 800 new cases here in Washington, pushing the state above the 50,000 mark for total cases since the start of the pandemic. Another 14 people died, bringing the total COVID-19 death toll in Washington to 1,482. The percent positive tests was down just slightly to 5.7%, but the governor says that's not the case statewide. And the more important number, the R-naught, representing the transmission rate, is too high right now, fueled mostly by large gatherings involving mostly young people, and really just people being around too many other people. Inslee says as it stands, Washington could be just a few weeks away from following Florida's path, ending up with thousands of new cases a day.
We've had tremendous success in flattening the curve, but we knew when we began this reopening process, we would have to accept and make changes as the facts dictated. We knew we would have to follow science as it emerged. We knew we would have to accept and adapt to changing circumstances. And we knew that we would have to face our challenges rather than to hide from them. And today, that's what we're going to do.
And it's going to have a major impact on bars, restaurants, and other businesses.
For restaurants and bars, indoor dining will be limited to members of the same household at the same table. Put simply, if you're looking for a seat with people you don't share a home with, you'll need to sit outside. If you're there with people who are in your household, you'll be allowed to sit indoors with the people in that household. And in phase three, the counties that are in phase three, table size will be reduced to 5 and occupancy to 50% of capacity indoors. We'll need alcohol service in restaurants to end at 10 p.m. and all bars will be closed for indoor service.
Weddings and funerals will also be impacted.
Now, our changes to health requirements for weddings and funerals apply both to secular and to religious services. Ceremonies are permitted. Receptions will not be prohibited. For all phases, the maximum occupancy of these events is 20% or up to 30 people, whichever is left. Less and accommodating for physical distancing will have to be required.
A 2-week grace period will be allowed for those weddings or funeral services already planned, putting everybody under the new rules by August 6th. The governor acknowledged that these decisions will have an impact on people having jobs and the economy overall. To that end, he extended a moratorium on evictions in the state through October, while also ordering the creation of a work group that will include landlords and tenants, among others, to find solutions to this crisis for housing moving forward.
Cutter Radio's Hannah Scott, she now joins us live. Hannah, did the governor give any indication of how long these expanded restrictions could go on for?
At the very minimum, at least a few weeks, and it could be longer than that. He really kind of stressed for everyone just to be prepared to hold this study until we can turn the numbers around significantly. The R-naught number, that transmission rate number, is above 1.5 or right around 1.5 at least, both in eastern and western Washington. And he said that has to drop significantly before anything can change. Also, you know, he had pushed pause on any county advancing to the next phase a couple of weeks ago. That was due to expire on the 28th. So just a couple of days from now, and that's not going to change either. So everyone's going to remain in the phase that they're in for right now with all of these new restrictions in place, and they're pretty significant for these bars and restaurants.
This could do some businesses in. I mean, many were hanging on by a thread already. Is there any extra relief coming from the state, or is it just federal relief at this point?
He is very much hoping to have some help from Congress with whenever this next package comes out, the stimulus package, that might be able to help again with some of these businesses that are suffering and maybe going to go under. You know, before we had the ability for some to be able to pay some of their employees, keep them on the payroll, even though businesses were closed back at the beginning of the shutdown. So perhaps something like that. And there's some help coming from the Department of Commerce. I don't know that it will be enough if this lasts long term. That's definitely going to be an issue. Other businesses, too, that are all out affected are family entertainment. So bowling alleys and mini golf courses that would be inside, it's all indoors. They're going to have to stay closed until the phase four, which is nowhere in sight.
I heard him mention something about movie theaters, that if you are going to see a flick with somebody, you know, outside of your household, that is still okay, but you can't, you know, eat with somebody outside of your household at a restaurant. What's the distinction there? Is it the fact that when you watch a movie, I guess you're not talking?
And possibly, but I mean, I guess it could be that you're not talking or that you're not eating as much. I don't know exactly, but yeah, the indoor movie theaters, they'll have reduced capacity under this to 25% if they're in phase three. They also, though, as you said, he made that distinction that it's okay to be with a friend at the movie theater, but not in the indoor restaurant. So I saw a lot of criticism actually about that comment later in the day. I'm not exactly sure what that means. He's really just telling all of us to just stay with the people that we live with in our homes, and that's the best way to get us out of these restrictions and advance into phases again here moving forward.
And the state health secretary, John Weisman, also joined Inslee for yesterday's news conference, and he is expanding the face mask mandate. What can you tell us about that?
I knew that that was going to be announced, but I didn't have any details. And I thought, I can't imagine what else he could do because it's already a statewide mandate. And really, it means you have to wear it in all common places, indoor or out. So elevators, any place like you're visiting in a nursing home or assisted living centers. Bottom line, when I asked him on a follow-up question, he said, really, any place outside of your house, you should be wearing the mask, any place at all, if you're going to be near anyone that's not living in your home. And then even in your home, if you've got anybody in your house that has tested positive, you need to mask up at home as well.
So what is mainly driving the decision, do you think, to expand these restrictions? I think he's going a little bit away from, talking about case numbers, and he's talking a lot about this R-naught number, so the infection rate and how many people are actually spreading it. Is that more important than the number of cases that are rising?
The R-naught number is one of the most important numbers because that is the transmission rate. So, again, that's for every one person who gets the virus, how many others they would pass it on to. So back at the height, we were getting it. We had an R-naught number of around 3. That's where you're into exponential growth. That's where you're seeing things like Florida is seeing right now. They had some graphs, the health department, earlier in the week that they showed us that kind of model our state right now against where Florida was, I believe, back at the beginning of June. And we are almost identical. We are very much looking like we could be on that path to where Florida is. Florida yesterday had nearly 10,000 new cases reported, and that's pretty much what their average has been. That is what their big concern is right now. So, yeah, that R-naught number is definitely going to be one of the most important.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
And, of course, every Friday morning we talk with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan. And as Colleen mentioned in her newscast, this is shaping up to be a potentially loud and contentious weekend in Seattle. We expect more protests. We expect also federal officers to try to protect any federal buildings near those protests. We've seen them in Portland. They're headed to Chicago and Albuquerque. And Margaret tells us that there's not much local politicians can do about it.
The thing that underpins this is the conviction of the Attorney General and the Justice Department that they have well within their rights, the ability to send federal agents to encircle and protect federal property in any city in the country. And then along with that, to conduct arrests of those who have committed a federal crime. But of course, that gets you into some pretty uncomfortable territory in terms of how that coexists with local law enforcement, how that's operationalized. And of course, we're in an election year, less than 100 days from an election in which President Trump's message is law and order. And there is the suspicion that this smells of politics, not just principle and law enforcement, as Attorney General Barr has argued it is.
And now we're seeing these clashes between federal officers and protesters in Portland are under investigation by the Justice Department Inspector General. They're also investigating those clashes in Washington, D.C. recently. What exactly are they looking into?
Well, that gets to the conduct, particularly of those federal agents. And when I sat down and interviewed Attorney General Bill Barr last month as part of what you just referenced there, the Lafayette Square incidents in which journalists and protesters were pushed back using pepper balls, chemical irritants, and forcibly removed from the area. It is that kind of activity. Was this, encroaching on a First Amendment right of a journalist to be there? Was this undue force that was used? It's how this was operationalized. And this is the question. And this is what skeptics of the argument would point to, which is when you have someone who is trained for Customs and Border Patrol or the Bureau of Prisons out there trying to quell a protest, they don't have the same sort of relationship with the community in which they are operating as your local law enforcement, and that adds a heightened level of tension to it all. But of course, the Justice Department argues that these federal agents were needed in these places because local law enforcement wasn't able to get these situations under control in the first place.
As you've mentioned, and the president has said himself, he is presenting himself as this law and order candidate. He said it himself. Do we have any indication that this hardline stance on crime is benefiting his reelection campaign?
Well, we'll get some answers to that this weekend with our latest battleground tracker, Anthony Salvanto, the CBS
elections guru will be with us to break that down, particularly in terms of how the heartland of this country is responding in this election year, but to big issues like the economy and the virus. But these images of trying to establish order or messaging that that is the intention behind it is something the Trump administration and Trump campaign has argued is helpful to them because it is suggestive to, you know, as the president tweeted this week, suburban women, whatever that means, are concerned. And so that is definitely part of a campaign strategy in what the president acknowledged. Whether it actually is a good one or a useful one is another matter.
Let's discuss now the latest round of coronavirus relief in Congress. The latest plan from Senate Republicans does not include a payroll tax cut, which the president has said he wants. Where does the bill stand today?
It is still unclear because Senate Republicans have not released the text of their compromise version with the White House. There is still disagreement between some Senate Republicans on what this will look like. You're right. The president even yesterday admitted that the payroll tax cut that he really wanted to have included wouldn't be in this version of the bill. He's already gesturing to the potential of yet another round of emergency relief. What we know is there's a lot of pressure in this moment to get a package done before the U.S. election. The Senate Republicans are eyeing the polls. They are concerned about maintaining their majority hold on that part of Capitol Hill and are also mindful of trying to target some of this aid, but do it in a way that doesn't add up to more than $1 trillion. That's still a lot of money, but it is less than what Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has proposed and already passed with her Heroes Bill in the House. Speaker Pelosi will be with us on Sunday to talk about what this next round of emergency relief could look like. It matters for people who are concerned about evictions. It matters for people who are concerned about how big the boost to their unemployment check will be if that extra $600 shrinks.
Right. Time's running out. That $600 runs out at the end of the month. What are your expectations here? Does the bill get done in time?
Well, there is a lot riding on this. Democrats seem to believe that they have some leverage because it is an election year, and who wants to say that nothing was done to help those who are facing those piling bills. But there's a tremendous amount of spending that's already happened. We have already seen trillions of dollars thrown at this problem, and it's a problem that is getting elongated by the fact that the virus is continuing to spread in these hotspots. Once you get the virus under control, you can get the economy back on track. And unfortunately, the surges have offset some of that recovery in the states, in the South, and in the West.
We heard from the president yesterday that he's calling off a portion of the Republican National Convention that was set for Jacksonville, Florida. What do you make of the president's shift in tone this week on the outbreak? He's now saying masks are patriotic, saying it's going to get worse before it gets better, saying right now is not the right time to hold a big convention. Why is his message changing?
You know, that's a good question. There's some speculation and reporting, including from some of my CBS colleagues, that it is based on the fact he's seeing poll numbers that show that he may be in trouble in certain states when it comes to the head-to-head matchup with Joe Biden. But this change in message also may be reflective of the fact that where the virus is surging are in states that, in many, with the exception of California here, were states that voted for President Trump in 2016. These were perceived to be red states, mostly red governors, mostly Republican governors, and they are seeing problems. So he is seeing leaders from within his own party really struggle with a virus that the White House had assured them was past its worst, that it was going to be better in these summer months, that there was enough equipment. And yet those governors, even though they saw what happened here on the East Coast of the country and out West as well, seem to be caught unprepared in many places. Arizona and Texas, they're playing catch up. South Carolina playing catch up. There's a real concern, and people are seeing infection rates and hospitalizations climb.
Also, lastly, I want to get your reaction to the latest tensions between the United States and China. There is this tit for tat happening, China ordering the U.S. to close a consulate in Chengdu. This is in direct retaliation to the U.S. closing China's consulate in Houston. You covered the State Department for a long time. How bad is the relationship right now?
It is an incredible point of tension. As you just mentioned, these shuttering of diplomatic facilities is an extreme example of that. It shows that the president's long-promised trade deal is totally on ice. It shows that the two largest economies in the world have not improved their relations. They have only spiked in tensions. And it's interesting because this is one of the very few bipartisan issues in the country. There is a desire to see American leaders be tough on China, to deal with all the problems we know exist in the trade relationship. And you're going to see candidate Joe Biden and President Donald Trump try to out-tough each other on this message. The Trump administration took that to another level this week, but specifically said that was due to espionage being conducted at American universities, medical facilities, and U.S. corporations, even indicted two hackers who were stealing research, some of it related to the coronavirus. So they're arguing, the Trump administration, that it has just reached a level of brazenness that they could not leave unaddressed and shuttered this Houston consulate this week.
That's Margaret Brennan, host of CBS's Face the Nation. And now to the latest on the COVID-19 outbreak, the runaway growth of the coronavirus in Washington state, prompting Governor Jay Inslee to issue new restrictions for businesses. We get the latest from Kiowa Radio's Hannah Scott.
Governor Inslee and health officials have been building up to it for days as daily cases of COVID-19 hit rolling averages for 2 weeks of more than double where they were just a few weeks ago, topping out at more than 1,000 cases a day in some days. Yesterday, the state health department reported nearly 800 new cases here in Washington, pushing the state above the 50,000 mark for total cases since the start of the pandemic. Another 14 people died, bringing the total COVID-19 death toll in Washington to 1,482. The percent positive tests was down just slightly to 5.7%, but the governor says that's not the case statewide. And the more important number, the R-naught, representing the transmission rate, is too high right now, fueled mostly by large gatherings involving mostly young people, and really just people being around too many other people. Inslee says as it stands, Washington could be just a few weeks away from following Florida's path, ending up with thousands of new cases a day.
We have had tremendous success in flattening the curve, but we knew when we began this reopening process, we would have to accept and make changes as the facts dictated. We knew we would have to follow science as it emerged. We knew we would have to accept and adapt to changing circumstances. And we knew that we would have to face our challenges rather than to hide from them. And today, that's what we're going to do.
And it's going to have a major impact on bars, restaurants, and other businesses.
For restaurants and bars, indoor dining will be limited to members of the same household at the same table. Put simply, if you're looking for a seat with people you don't share a home with, you'll need to sit outside. If you're there with people who are in your household, you'll be allowed to sit indoors with the people in that household. And in phase three, the counties that are in phase three, table size will be reduced to 5 and occupancy to 50% of capacity indoors. We'll need alcohol service in restaurants to end at 10 p.m. and all bars will be closed for indoor service.
Weddings and funerals will also be impacted.
Now, our changes to health requirements for weddings and funerals apply both to secular and to religious services. Ceremonies are permitted. Receptions will not be prohibited. For all phases, the maximum occupancy of these events is 20% or up to 30 people, whichever is left. Less and accommodating for physical distancing will have to be required.
A 2-week grace period will be allowed for those weddings or funeral services already planned, putting everybody under the new rules by August 6th. The governor acknowledged that these decisions will have an impact on people having jobs and the economy overall. To that end, he extended a moratorium on evictions in the state through October, while also ordering the creation of a work group that will include landlords and tenants, among others, to find solutions to this crisis for housing moving forward.
Kiowa Radio's Hannah Scott, she now joins us live. Hannah, did the governor give any indication of how long these expanded restrictions could go on for?
At the very minimum, at least a few weeks, and it could be longer than that. He really kind of stressed for everyone just to be prepared to hold this study until we can turn the numbers around significantly. The R-naught number, that transmission rate number, is above 1.5 or right around 1.5 at least, both in eastern and western Washington. And he said that has to drop significantly before anything can change. Also, you know, he had pushed pause on any county advancing to the next phase a couple of weeks ago. That was due to expire on the 28th. So just a couple of days from now, and that's not going to change either. So everyone's going to remain in the phase that they're in for right now with all of these new restrictions in place, and they're pretty significant for these bars and restaurants.
This could do some businesses in. I mean, many were hanging on by a thread already. Is there any extra relief coming from the state, or is it just federal relief at this point?
He is very much hoping to have some help from Congress with whenever this next package comes out, the stimulus package, that might be able to help again with some of these businesses that are suffering and maybe going to go under. You know, before we had the ability to for some to be able to pay some of their employees, keep them on the payroll, even though businesses were closed back at the beginning of the shutdown. So perhaps something like that. And there's some help coming from the Department of Commerce. I don't know that it will be enough if this lasts long term. That's definitely going to be an issue. Other businesses, too, that are all out affected are family entertainment. So bowling alleys and mini golf courses that would be inside, it's all indoors. They're going to have to stay closed or closed down until the phase four, which is nowhere in sight.
I heard him mention something about movie theaters, that if you are going to see a flick with somebody, you know, outside of your household, that is still okay. But you can't, you know, eat with somebody outside of your household at a restaurant. What's the distinction there? Is it the fact that when you watch a movie, I guess you're not talking?
And possibly, but I mean, I guess it could be that you're not talking or that you're not eating as much. I don't know exactly, but yeah, the indoor movie theaters, they'll have reduced capacity under this to 25% if they're in phase three. They also, though, as you said, he made that distinction that it's okay to be with a friend at the movie theater, but not in the indoor restaurant. So I saw a lot of criticism actually about that comment later in the day. I'm not exactly sure what that means. He's really just telling all of us to just stay with the people that we live with in our homes, and that's the best way to get us out of these restrictions and advance into phases again here moving forward.
And the state health secretary, John Weisman, also joined Inslee for yesterday's news conference, and he is expanding the face mask mandate. What can you tell us about that?
I knew that was going to be announced, but I didn't have any details, and I thought, I can't imagine what else he could do because it's already a statewide mandate. And really, it means you have to wear it in all common places, indoor or out, so elevators, any place like you're visiting in a nursing home or assisted living centers. Bottom line, when I asked him on a follow-up question, he said, really, any place outside of your house, you should be wearing the mask any place at all if you're going to be near anyone that's not living in your home. And then even in your home, if you've got anybody in your house that has tested positive, you need to mask up at home as well.
So what is mainly driving the decision, do you think, to expand these restrictions? I think he's going a little bit away from, you know, talking about case numbers, and he's talking a lot about this R-naught number, so the infection rate and how many people are actually spreading it. Is that more important than the number of cases that are rising?
The R-naught number is one of the most important numbers because that is the transmission rate. So again, that's for every one person who gets the virus, how many others they would pass it on to. So back at the height, we were getting it. We had an R-naught number of around 3. That's where you're into exponential growth. That's where you're seeing things like Florida is seeing right now. They had some graphs, the health department earlier in the week, that they showed us that kind of model our state right now against where Florida was, I believe, back at the beginning of June. And we are almost identical. We are very much looking like we could be on that path to where Florida is. Florida yesterday had nearly 10,000 new cases reported. And that's pretty much what their average has been. That is what their big concern is right now. So, yeah, that R-naught number is definitely going to be one of the most important.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
in a complete opposite side of the news spectrum. Your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak, enlist with Novak.com, the ripple effect of an act of kindness. Shotaro Sims of Kansas City, Missouri, found a lucky $1 bill. Lucky because it led her to a scratch ticket that was a $100 winner. With only $7 to her name at the time and bills past due, it was a series of fortunate events for sure. But when she told her 12-year-old daughter about it, that 12-year-old suggested they donate it instead. And she wanted to donate it to an officer in Kansas City who had just been shot in the line of duty. Sims knew it was the right thing to do. The 12-year-old's sister had just been killed in October, so they knew what it was like to go through hardship. Sims says the officers who handled the case went above and beyond for her family.
They did a lot. They were father, therapists, they were everything.
When Sims donated to help the wounded officer, police say they were overwhelmed.
To hear her call and just express thanks for no reason other than she's thankful, it's really impactful to us, and it's really touching to us.
The officers decided they wanted to pay it forward, too, starting a GoFundMe for Sims, which has raised more than $8,000 now. But Sims didn't leave her name or number when she made that donation, so it took police days to track her down and let her know that good news.
Police know how to track him down too, I bet. What a confluence of events, though.
I mean, I know.
With everything happening in the political landscape and all of this, it's nice to hear that.
Absolutely.
And now, as we await G. Scott, I think we're having some connection issues at the moment. Colleen and I are going to do our best.
We're so great for a segment like this. Let's talk sports.
Talk about baseball.
You're all in. You're like a secret sportscaster, too, aren't you?
Thankfully, we don't have to talk about my fanaticism with baseball because we do have G. Scott
now. G's back. Woo, thanks for saving the day, G.
We'll get back into that, though. G.
What's up, bro?
His style, impetuous. Defense is impregnable. We're talking about Mike Tyson, age 54, and he's getting back in the boxing ring. Who you got, G? He's taking on Roy Jones Jr.
Mike Tyson all the way. Are you kidding me?
Why is that?
Do you guys know how excited I am about September 12th? Here's why, Colin. There is nobody that would get the crowd, get the viewers at home as excited about boxing the way Mike Tyson did. Don't talk about him out the ring because he's...
That's what I was going to ask. I wasn't sure whether to feel conflicted about him. Aren't boxers typically controversial?
Not that guy out the ring.
Okay.
But in the ring, like this is an opportunity for us dads, us moms, us uncles, us aunties to have a chance to finally show our kids what we have been talking about. Now, unfortunately, it's probably going to be like... an example of when we do show our kids a television show from back in the day and our kids are looking at us like, you used to like this?
Is he still viable at 54?
Probably not.
Okay.
But here's what I'm thinking is going to happen. Have you guys watched the movie Rocky IV? That's when Ivan Drago fights Apollo Creed in the first fight in the show. And Apollo Creed didn't make it. And I'm thinking that if Roy Jones Jr. isn't careful, he might get hit with something. Because there's one thing about Mike Tyson. I don't know the type of shape that he is, but I still think that he can punch. And I'm so excited to watch it. And I just feel like I'm a 10-year-old all over again being excited about this fight.
Okay.
So I do think Mike Tyson is going to win because Roy Jones Jr., he can't take a punch very well.
And Roy Jones Jr. isn't a young buck. I just looked it up. He's 51.
Oh.
So, I mean, you know, come on.
So is him.
Hey, Colleen, you ever know somebody in your family that maybe they are in their 50s, but you can say, like, hey, they're still strong.
Absolutely.
Like you might shake their hand.
54 is by no means an old age, but when you've been hit in the head in other regions for your whole life, just like we talk about football players where their careers end in their late 20s because their bodies are so beat up. That's why I ask, is Mike Tyson at 54... can he still move at an impetuous pace?
Yes. I don't know if have you seen the videos of him working out? Oh my God. He's like lightning quick still.
Okay.
Yes.
So be good then. What about that undercard game, though? Nate Robinson against, who is it, YouTuber?
Against Jake Paul. Like, Who is this guy? Why is he famous?
I gotta Google it.
I don't know who Jake Paul is, but I do remember watching Nate Robinson back at Rainier Beach High School. I went to high school around the same time as him, actually. So, yeah. I didn't know he was a boxer, though. Do you know anything about Nate's boxing background?
I'm looking at some pictures of him early on in his YouTube career. He's a skinny little guy. It looks like he's beefed up, though, so perhaps he's a legit boxer.
I think all those around the Seattle area that has known Nate since he was a kid or had known Nate since high school or college, or when, of course, watching him in his, I think, 11-year NBA career, if there's one thing about Nate that we know, there's nothing he can't do athletically. Mm-hmm. He can absolutely do anything athletically, winning the Apple Cup back in, I think the year was 2000, I don't remember who it was, but when he played for UW, Nate Robinson is going to absolutely crush this dude. Absolutely crush him. He's going to represent Seattle. We're going to be excited. Look, guys, I'm more excited. Let me tell you this. I'm more excited about September 12th when these fights take place than I am for the start of college or pro football.
I got to say, I am too, G, because I was still pretty young, you know, like when Mike Tyson was in his heyday.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I've seen the clips. I know his history, and that is a bad man.
Bad man. He last fought in 2005. So 15 years ago was the last time that Iron Mike was in the ring. And I think, look, the good news is Roy Jones Jr. is 51, like Colleen looked up, and Mike is 54.
Yeah.
Hey, two guys in their 50s fighting it out, all's fair.
G,
I think Mike's gonna mess him up.
I think so too.
What's
up? Did you watch any of the baseball yesterday?
I tweeted about it. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
oh, you did.
Yes, I did.
I like it. I don't mind the piped in sound.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, here's my question back at you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it because I didn't have my debit card or my credit card on me. Would you guys pay the $30 to have your face on the screen?
For sure.
You mean those cardboard cutouts that you're talking about?
Sure. I do it for my husband or my daughter, like a cheap thrill for them, probably not myself. But yeah, I mean.
See?
Sure.
I love it. I don't know. Look.
Goes to charity, right?
I was watching the Dodgers game yesterday, and I was watching that. Before that, I was watching Cornhole. And as you guys know, I watch birds now. I'm a bird watcher. Let me tell you something about this quarantine. This quarantine has us all appreciating the things that in life that we used to take for granted. You know, you're just like, oh, it's a baseball game. Whatever. I'll watch something else. Uh-uh. Yesterday, baseball. Today, baseball.
Yeah.
Hey, give it all to me,
just
everybody.
Human interaction. Just, anytime I make a trip to the grocery store and somebody talks to me, I'm like, oh, you want to say words to each other? You know, it feels good.
So, yeah, I was definitely excited about it. I didn't know that I would be. I thought like, oh, that's corny about the whole, you know, stock pictures and you can pay for it. And then I'm watching the game and I'm seeing it and I'm like, no, that would be pretty cool. It was great.
Speaking of changing your mind on things, now that it's official, the Seattle NHL team is the Kraken. How you feeling about it? What's Kraken, G?
Would it make everybody mad if I tell you guys this? I just really don't. The name isn't really.
Careful.
What? I just. Was like,
I'm all in. I'm like the number one fan now of this team. So careful.
Okay, here's what I love. I love the logo. I love the uniform. Oh, do you call it sweater or jersey?
I don't know.
I've seen sweater. I always thought it was a jersey.
I heard sweater. I want to be, make sure I'm PC, right? Anyways, when it comes to this, but the name, Crack, oh, man.
It's bad. I love it. I wrote,
really
I said,
do?
Finally, a local sports team with an actual intimidating name. The Storm is the closest we have. And now the menacing Kraken.
It's bad.
I love it.
Hey, G, you like it?
You take a dip in the waters and don't tell me something creepy brushing up against your leg isn't intimidating.
I didn't like it at first.
It to me every time.
I've come around to it. I'm okay with it now. Go Kraken. I'm all in. G. Scott, thanks. We'll hear you at 9 o'clock.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Last week, we interviewed Laura Starczewski, a reporter and series producer for the podcast Reveal. And this particular episode concerned Senecor, C-E-N-I-K-O-R. A drug rehab program which uses work as therapy. But the series alleges that it was a truly bizarre form of rehab because it involved 2 years of backbreaking labor in one case. And essentially, the patients become squads of unpaid laborers, as they describe, and that the bottom line is, for most of them, it doesn't work. So after we broadcast that interview, we got a call from a listener, David Butterfield, who said he went to a similar program, but his experience was entirely different. And so, David, I want you to tell your story. Tell me about the program that you were in.
I loved it. Actually, one of the best decisions I ever made was to get into that program.
Now, you were actually in Centocor, the one that they profiled?
No, I'm not familiar with that. But that type of program is very, very – there's a lot of them in the United States. And they're actually faith-based. They're called discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
And, we worked a lot. But when you go in there and you meet with them to, you know, sign up, they tell you that there is a lot of work involved and you will be working. They give you a week to two to get your mind right, to get, you know, figure out where you're at. But they tell you, look, that's how you pay it forward. You go on these work blessings, you do the work, they donate to the program, and it helps pay for, you know, the food. So we all worked to pay the bills to keep the thing going to help the next guy. And it was because of that program that I got my spiritual connection with my Savior Jesus. If it wasn't for that program, I wouldn't be who I was today.
So what was your addiction? What were you trying to get over?
I was trying to get off of heroin and meth.
Mm-hmm. Had you signed up for the program or did you get in trouble and get assigned to it?
What had happened was I got in trouble and I was in King County Jail. I had just done 9 months there.
For what?
I was in violation of a no contact order.
Uh-huh.
I actually had just gotten out of prison in L.A. So I was fresh out of prison. Violated my DOC and was sitting in King County Jail. And my mom had came in and said, hey, I went to this program, kicked alcohol here. It's a really good program. She had a few of the brothers from the program come into the jail and minister to me. And when I told the judge about it, he was like, absolutely. I've heard many stories about this place. The judge actually knew of the program and was like, yes. He knew of, he sent a lot of people there. And yeah, you know, the turnaround rate is probably, you know, there's probably more people that come and go there than get help, but it's free. It's something that, you know what I mean? The doors are always open there. They know that it's a rough road. And if you leave, you're welcome to come back because it's free. You don't have to go through the state to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a really good place. It's a very, very good place.
Okay. So what kind of work did they have you doing?
Oh, they go around and they do landscaping for people in the church. Odd jobs. They had a contract to do like some cleanup on the side of the road. We did some party setup and demo. Oh, we did some security for CenturyLink Field. So it was all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah. So and was that considered part of the therapy? What did the work teach you, if anything?
Well, the work taught me the work ethic. It taught me that it was more to be happy and be content and give back, because for so long I took. It wasn't about me. It was about what this work, what me doing, was going to be able to accomplish in the kingdom of God. That's mm-hmm. what it was about. And if you didn't have that mindset, you probably weren't going to be there. But people who went through that program and succeeded really wanted to sober and they wanted to change. And that's really what it comes down to anyways. Whatever recovery center it is, whether it's secular or faith-based, if you don't want to get clean, you're not going to get clean.
Right. It might, I guess, surprise some people that the county would send you to a religious program, but that's your choice, right?
Yes, it is. It is my choice. And that's the whole, and they know that too. They know that it's not state sanctioned, you know, mm-hmm. but they have a lot of good rapport with that place, with those places. So.
So what are you doing now?
I work full time. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter that I raise with my fiance.
Uh-huh.
We have our own little apartment. Yeah, we're just a happy little family now. I did drugs and did the wrong thing for, I'm 39 now. So since I was 13, I've been doing drugs and I've been clean now, seriously clean, 2.5 years. So I did a lot of damage to myself, but it was a combination of not wanting to do that anymore, my daughter being born, and just finally being okay with myself and who I was.
Yeah, having a little person completely dependent on you can change your life.
Completely change your life.
Yeah. So are you completely free and clear now, or are you still on probation? What's your status?
I'm completely free and clear.
That's a great success story.
I actually restored my voting rights, so I've never been able to vote. I recently got those back, so I'm kind of excited about how, you know, life's turning out once you finally make that decision to stop.
Well, congratulations. We don't get to hear too many stories like that. I'm not sure why. Do you the picture I got from talking to Laura was that most of these programs are well-intentioned, but don't get the job done. So are you unique? Are you a unicorn here, or are there a lot of people like you who have come through these programs successfully?
There's a lot of people like me that I know quite a few that have come through successfully, but there's also probably 75% more that don't successfully do it.
And why is that? Why is that? Did you know people who didn't get through, and what was the reason they failed?
A lot of times they just weren't willing to, you know, surrender everything. Because when you get into these programs, you get into the mindset that you're going to try to live your life as the disciples live when they follow Jesus. So you got to surrender everything. You know, your family knows you're going into treatment, so you got to not worry about your family. And a lot of time people have outside forces pulling them out. Sometimes at the first of the month when they get their checks, they take off and they go get drunk or whatever. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we find homeless people in downtown Seattle and we take them to the program. So
could that look to somebody looking at it from the outside like being brainwashed, this idea of surrender?
Yes, absolutely. It could look like brainwash and a cult. And, you know, I've heard people try to argue good arguments that, hey, you're following a cult. No, I don't really consider it a cult because they're not making me what they're having, asking me to worship is the word of God, Jesus Christ. They're not keeping me from the outside world. My family knows where I'm at. Mm-hmm. You know, we're intermingling with the outside world. We're not secluded anywhere. You know what I mean? And people are like, well, they're brainwashing you. Well, you know what? For 38 years, my brain was dirty and I was doing the wrong things. A little brainwash would probably do.
Is that an original line from you, or did you learn that?
Yes. No, that's an original.
Good for you. Well, David, thanks for calling. I'm glad you heard the program, and I'm glad to be able to tell your story.
Thank you, Dave. And you just keep fighting the good fight. And thank you again for hearing my story.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.